From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Our reporter Stephen Sefton in Nicaragua recently visited the Bosawas Biosphere Reserve in that country, which is at a meeting point between the fauna of North and South America and hosts an enormous amount of both vertebrate and invertebrate organisms. Geographically, it's in the northeastern part of the country and shares an international border with Honduras. We spoke with him via Skype from Nicaragua on Wednesday. Stephen, welcome back from your journey deep into the heart of Nicaragua. Maybe you could talk to us about your trip over the past week or so.
Yeah, I've been out of touch for about 4 days because I was walkabout in northern Nicaragua's Bosawas Biosphere Reserve.
What is that?
Bosawas is the biggest biosphere reserve north of the Amazon. Often people refer to it as the lungs of Central America, which may or may not be the case. Right. But I mean, the reason I was there is that it's a very contested area, both on the ground and ideologically in the ideological battle between the imperialists and their neo-colonial left accomplices, trying to build a genuine anti-imperialist, independent, sovereign nation here in Nicaragua, integrated into a sovereign Latin America and Caribbean region. And it seems to me that that is the basic struggle, especially in terms of what you and I do, Don, in terms of our communications work, right, which is, and what did Fidel Castro call it? The Battle of Ideas, a more interesting description that he used, that Fidel Castro used, than the Battle of Ideas. But what you and I and everybody working in defense of anti-imperialist ideas and of the sovereign rights to independence and self-determination of the peoples are involved in this ideological battle. And arraigned on the other side are all the corporate media serving imperialist elite interests and their neo-colonial left accomplices. The reason I went to Bosawas was because there was yet another incident which has been completely distorted and manipulated by organizations, especially non-governmental organizations posing as defenders of the environment and indigenous peoples, who are practically invariably some version of the neo-colonial left or phony progressives, who are essentially accomplices to imperialist and corporate elite interests in the region, because what they're trying to do is undermine the national sovereignty and independence of national governments.
Right.
So the incident was an attack on a community right in the center of the Bosawas Biosphere Reserve, in which at least 9 people died, according to the police investigation. They have captured 3 or 4 of the people who carried out the attack, and there are something like 11 or 12 people whom they've identified by name who are on the run and may well still be in the area. But the important thing to note is that both the perpetrators and the victims of the attack were indigenous peoples, principally. Principally members of the Mayangna Nation. The Mayangna is an ethnic group mostly in northern Nicaragua. I think there is a small Mayangna group down in the Rio San Juan in the southeast of the country, but most of the Mayangna Nation are up in the area around Bosawas. And their historic center is a town called Musawas. And the area is controlled by the Mayangna Nation. They have their own system of what do you call Guardabosques, the the people that take care of the forest rangers. I suppose that's the term.
Yeah, forest ranger. Yeah. Now, Smokey the Bear, only you can prevent forest fires and all. They call them forest rangers.
So the Mayangna Nation have their own system of forest rangers. They patrol the area. They own the land as a result of the government of Nicaragua extending them a communal title to the land. Oh, a huge extension. I don't know the area in square kilometers, but it's a very extensive area in and around the Bosawas Biosphere Reserve. So the Mayangna and nation authorities control the land. And in theory, that land can't be sold. It can only be leased. And this is very similar to the situation in the Miskito indigenous peoples areas further to the east around the city of Bilwi and around the city of Waspam in the north, the northeastern corner of Nicaragua. So the Mayangna people control the land. They're not supposed to sell it. They can't sell it. It's illegal to sell it. But in fact, they do. And they don't just sell it to one individual or one group of families. They'll sell, what we discovered in our visit to the site of the attack is that the motive for the attack is that the corrupt Mayangna leaders, the corrupt local Mayangna leaders who sold the land, they wanted to sell it to somebody else. And the same land. And so what they were trying to do was to scare off the people whom they'd originally sold it to, so that they could then sell the land on to another buyer, or else occupy it themselves, because the area is rich in gold. That part of Nicaragua is known as the Mining Triangle. And with gold at around, what is it now, $1,800 an ounce?
Something ridiculous, yeah.
With gold at that kind of price, gold is a very, very attractive activity. And in northern Nicaragua, there's only one big mining company, a mining company called Hemco, which is based in Bonanza, the municipal capital of the area in which we were trekking. And Hemco is a big company with a long history in the region that works closely with all the relevant authorities, the national authority, the regional authority, the municipal authority, and the indigenous people's authorities. And so you can imagine that with that network of entities, it's very, very difficult to avoid corruption at a grassroots level, or even at a middle management level, to put it in that way.
Right.
And so in a context with gold at that price, with corrupt local leaders, it's not surprising that this incident took place. And it involved, it was Mayangna on Mayangna, with some Miskitos involved as victims as well, and with some mestizos working with some hired killers, working with the Mayangna gang that attacked the victims. Now, what were the victims doing? They were doing artisanal mining. And when we trekked up to the site, we found a very extensive network with lots of machinery, the mills that they use to mill the what they do is they dig into the hillside, they dig tunnels into the hillside, extract the what do you call the streak of gold? There's a word for that.
The ore.
They extract the ore from the seam of gold that they find inside the hillside. They carry that earth out to broad daylight where they have their machinery. They put it into mills, they mill it, and they use mercury and other materials to separate the gold from the earth, from the mud.
Right, which today, by the way, the spot price today is $17.97.10. Last week it was 18-something. It was down 7% from last week.
Right. So what does that mean? What that means is that these people were carrying out an extremely contaminating industrial mining activity, or no, not an artisanal mining activity, contaminating the water. There was a creek that ran right down the hillside, that on either side of the creek were the works of these artisanal miners. And so what were they doing? They were creating a situation that would very dangerous for themselves, because very steep hillsides, they were putting themselves at risk from landslides. Right. But they were also contaminating the water with mercury.
Right.
We couldn't drink the water from that creek, because on our trek up the mountain, which took us about 4 hours, every 10 or 15 minutes, there were these wonderful, beautiful creeks flowing down the mountainside. So, although I lost my water bottle, it didn't matter, because every 10 or 15 minutes I could get a drink of this wonderful crystal clear water. And so on our way up the hillside, we reached this creek that is totally contaminated now. Also, to set up their encampment, they had to deforest that part of the biosphere reserve in order to be able to set up their camp. So you have, who is responsible for that? It's not the national government that's responsible for that. It's the local Mayangna nation that's responsible for that.
Now, let me make something clear to our listeners on this, just a very quick summary. What we're talking about here in Nicaragua, the government helps and set aside, conveys communal title to the indigenous peoples of this region or that, the land that belongs to them, or that it's agreed is going to belong to them going forward. By the way, it even acknowledged and accepted the UN guidelines in 2010 for dealing with these various indigenous groups, and they set up these preserves, basically, that are supposed to be, keep the land pure and livable. There's a whole network of these around the world, of these biosphere reserves, and so they set them up in Nicaragua, which allows local administration by the community of these properties, and somehow in the middle of that, corporate interests weasel their way into having local people go in and poison from the inside out these biosphere reserves to grab the gold. It's almost a metaphor for what's been happening for 500 years there.
Yeah, in this case, Don, although in many cases around the world, obviously, corporate interests are involved, in this case, there are no corporate interests involved. This is like local organized crime. And they, obviously, with gold at that price, they sold a concession. The indigenous people sold a concession, as well as selling the land. They right. sold the concession to mine.
Right.
And so...
But to whom? In other words, they didn't. They sold it to each other, or they sold it to corporate interests on the outside?
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. It's like, if you steal my TV, you're just a junkie who broke into my house to steal my TV. If there's a shop downtown that everybody takes the stolen TVs to, well, that guy's involved. And that's what I was talking about.
Absolutely. Yes, you're right. So... So, just to give an idea to people what the amount of money involved, let me do a quick calculation of to get the amount in dollars, because I know the amount in the local currency here, cordobas, but I don't know the amount in dollars. So let me just
do
that.
Well, you do that. I'll just remind people, for $1,800 an ounce. That's what this gold retails for on the spot markets this morning, $1,797.10 to be precise, U.S. dollars. Per ounce. How much gold is in one of those mountains?
So this mining community, we asked the local people, what that mining community would generate in terms of income for the families working on it. And remember, there must have been over 100 people working on this site. Mm-hmm. in the encampment. There were kind of makeshift shelters all over the place, as well as the actual mining equipment. That operation was generating between $7,000 and $10,000 a month.
Whoa.
So in a country where
that's a lot of money there.
The minimum wage is something like, it's not, I don't think it's even $200 a month, the minimum wage here. So that activity was very, very profitable and obviously a target for unscrupulous, ruthless individuals who were hoping to make a lot of money in their terms out of intimidating these miners either into paying them more or to clear them off the land and get other people in who would pay them more. So,
you know, if you look at the CIA or World Bank numbers for Nicaragua, about 1,912.90 U.S. dollars per capita per annum in Nicaragua GDP. About the same as 1 ounce, 1 ounce of gold at retail, spot retail prices is about the annual income or annual GDP of each person in Nicaragua. So this is a lot of money for these folks.
Yes. So I don't want to dwell too much on this, but one of the reasons that I was anxious to talk about it, Don, is that it just shows up the organizations like the Oakland Institute or other organizations like Global Witness, which are based in London, they receive huge quantities of money from corporate interests, supposedly to, in the case of the Oakland Institute, I think they receive a lot of money from the son of Howard Buffett, hundreds of thousands of dollars from the son of Howard Buffett.
Is Howard Buffett related to Warren Buffett? I'm not sure.
And Howard Buffett is the son of Warren Buffett.
Gotcha. Okay.
And Howard Buffett, and he's quite an interesting individual. But let's not get into that. I don't want to get off the subject. The point is that outfits like the Oakland Institute and Global Witness will use incidents like the one I've just described to attack the government. They won't tell the truth about what actually happened because they don't. It's not in their interest to report the truth.
Right.
There's this chain, this kind of food chain, whereby local environmental NGOs will lie about what happened, feed those lies into NGOs like Global Witness and the Oakland Institute and into corporate media, and that then becomes the official version for everyone around the world about what's happening in Nicaragua.
This is the same here in the United States, okay, where we have, let's say, the latte left or however you want to characterize it, people who are sitting behind the bombs and missiles that are launched at everyone else in the world and criticize it softly from the left. We are confronted with or fed a steady diet of things like stand up for the indigenous rights of people in Nicaragua who are fighting the big oppressive China monster that wants to build a canal through here so they can get rich on the backs of indigenous peoples once again. Or stand up for the rights of indigenous peoples in this part or that part of the United States to have independent decision-making at their own level when the matter at hand is discussion of whether or not to build a casino. Right now, cattle or buffalo or whatever are being fed from natural waters. They want to put a casino on it, some small group. In other words, the entire actual purpose of these things is inverted, and there are people that are pushed out front to us to symbolize resistance in one way or another that are actually accomplices of people that are doing the very crime these people are organizing themselves to fight.
Yeah, and we shouldn't, of course, we have to be careful not to try and undermine genuine
absolutely
people's resistance. But I think it's important to acknowledge that not every case is what it seems.
True.
So I think that, I don't know if we have time, Don, but I think we should try and link that to the whole idea of national and regional independence and sovereignty.
We have 8 minutes. If you can do it in 8 minutes, let's hit it.
Yeah, okay. So, because today is a very important anniversary for Mexico and Central America. Today in Mexico is the anniversary of the Grito de Dolores in 1810, which was the start of the final independent struggle in Mexico. And today is also the anniversary of the Central American Declaration of Independence in, when was it, 1821? I think that's it.
And today being, by the way, September 15th, when we're having this conversation.
September the 15th. So it's a big anniversary for Mexico and Central America. And what does that mean now? What have we got? A couple of centuries of independence now? And this year is the bicentenary year for Central American independence. And there's a big celebration of that here in Nicaragua, in Honduras, in El Salvador. And when one looks at that, well, what does independence mean now, after 200 years of constant struggle against neo-colonial domination? The nations won their independence. Haiti won its independence. But what happened? What happened was that the European powers initially, and subsequently superseded by the United States, continued to impose their control and domination on the region, arresting the region's development. For the benefit of the region's peoples.
Yeah.
After the Cuban Revolution in 1959, followed by the Nicaraguan Revolution 20 years later in 1979, followed by Hugo Chavez's astonishing revolutionary process, Bolivarian process in Venezuela, and that Hugo Chavez and other regional leaders referred to as the second independence. Right. They're talking, and because they're absolutely crystal clear that the first independence was an independence only in name. And what we're doing, what is happening now, what all of us here in the region struggling to defeat U.S. domination and the accompanied by the pathetic, craven leaders of the European Union countries that are still nostalgic for their colonial days, that they and the corporate elites that those political leaders represent are still trying to control the region, control all of Latin America and the Caribbean. And what we're seeing in the region at the moment is a kind of very uneven, broken-up process in which U.S. control and that of its European allies is steadily breaking down, but in a very uneven way. And so the independence celebrations here in Central America, for example, take place in a context whereby Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are very much still under the thumb of U.S. control, right, despite the fact that Nayib Bukele is ostensibly, for appearances, criticized by the United States authorities for his authoritarianism. But it's an authoritarianism that's okay with the United States because right, he's attacking the genuinely progressive forces in El Salvador. Right. So he's actually engaging in a process that will consolidate U.S. control and international corporate control. Right. Likewise, Guatemala and Honduras, also Costa Rica, perhaps less so, but in all those countries, for today, an example in Guatemala and El Salvador, there are mass demonstrations against the government. Mm. In Costa Rica, there's strong demonstrations against the government. And that which is the most stable country in the region? Nicaragua.
Right.
Which is the country that is most criticized by the United States.
Of course. Its people like it best. So, of course, that's a problem for the United States that would like to come in and loot at will.
Right. So, and another sign of how U.S. control is breaking down is that thanks to AMLO, the Mexican president, Andrés yeah. Manuel López Obrador, yep. there's now a process happening, a dialogue process between the Venezuelan government and the Venezuelan, even the far right, the extreme right-wing opposition in Venezuela. There's a dialogue process taking place in Mexico, kind of approved by the United States. And what that dialogue process means is that a United States policy politically in Venezuela has completely failed. They're going to go ahead with their elections, as will Nicaragua later in the year. Those elections will validate the country's government, and the pathetic puppet Juan Guaido,
who may go on trial sometime soon. People are working on that.
Yeah, and he now faces being tried essentially for treason by the Venezuelan authorities. And so whereas on the one hand you've got the United States maintaining different levels of control, for example, in the Northern Triangle, the so-called Northern Triangle here in Central America. In other parts of the region, their control is completely breaking down.
Let me just point something out, by the way. You were right when you were fishing around in your memory. I say at our age, what's left of your memory, for the date. It is 1821, and I'll remind or point out that today is the bicentennial.
Right. Today is the bicentennial. So it's a very big celebration here in the region. And I think it's, and if we have a chance in another program, we should probably look in more in a broader way, because we've talked a lot about Nicaragua today, at what independence means under current conditions in the region, in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yeah, there are a multiplicity of forms of relating to the empire from Central America, as is true of the whole world. Nicaragua stands more or less in opposition to the attempts by the U.S. To control the destiny of its people and to provide both sovereignty, self-determination, and a level of dignity for the people that live there. This is more freely allowed or taken than anywhere else in Central America. And you have different models of control by the U.S. at different levels levels of penetration of the society in each of the countries of Central America, like you have around South America, the Caribbean, Africa, and Asia.
Right. No, I think that's a very important point to make, Tom, the speed of the process of U.S. decline, the decline of U.S. interest and U.S. influence and U.S. control in Latin America and the Caribbean, operates very unevenly, precisely in proportion to the level of penetration that U.S. interests have managed to achieve in the respective countries in the region.
Right. And, you know, if you look at a map of Central America from the point of view of geopolitics, and I'll even say something as crude as the old domino theory that they used in Southeast Asia and Asia generally, you have Mexico with the changes you describe at the north end, and then reaching all the way into South America, the only thing stopping reaching Venezuela and Ecuador, which regardless of whatever government's there at the moment, there's very strong progressive forces and processes in operation. Colombia in the middle of it being thwarted, which has been a major battlefield for 60 some odd years now. And if, say, Colombia were to end up with a true leftist government by some machinations, the entire situation between Mexico and Colombia, you know, you would have a domino effect, possibly, that certainly I think it's something that the CIA and Washington are scared to death of.
Oh, yeah. If there's change in Colombia, the whole region will change.
Yep.
That's absolutely clear, because Colombia is kind of the Israel of Latin America.
Yes, so it is.
From the United States point of view.
Right where it's situated, yep.
And so in those countries too, some of those countries are having bicentennial celebrations of their independence.
I think we got to stop here because we are completely out of time, but let's pick it up here next week, Stephen, okay? Thank you so much.
Sure thing, John. Thanks a million. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for coming along.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.